This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for December 2009. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poets reading their poems and talk about an article in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Valzina Mort.
I cannot tell between beggars' stretched hands and dogs' dripping tongues.
And Jill Alexander Espow.
We shall not cover up in quilts or bear the beasts of one another's guilts.
We'll also speak with John Kinsella about whether poetry is good for the environment.
I think so. I think the poets are at the forefront of resisting environmental damage and encroachment, even if they're not conscious of it.
Also in the December issue, we have poems by Franz Wright, Philip Levine, and Amy Beeder. Don, before we hear from the poets we're going to feature today, is there anything you'd like to read or quote from especially?
Yes, I was interested in the poem we have by James Lasden. Seems like it's been a while since I've seen poems of his. Been a few years since his last book of poems. And our poem in this issue is called It Isn't Me. I'll just read a little bit of it. It starts off, "It isn't me," he'd say, stepping out of a landscape that offered, he thought, the backdrop to a plausible existence until he entered it. "It's just not me," he'd murmur, walking away. "It's not quite me," he'd explain, apologetic but firm, leaving some job they'd found him. They'd found him others. He'd go, smiling his smile, putting his best foot forward, till again he'd find himself reluctantly concluding that this too wasn't him. And it goes on, putting its best feet forward.
Well, it sounds like it's a poet you're talking, right? Can't quite fit into any job, can't quite fit into positions. And Lasden, you know, he's English, but he lives upstate on a farm now. I think he makes his living by farming and writing novels.
Yeah. I like the way the poem ends. Only sometimes, alone in offices or living rooms, they'd hear that phrase again, "It isn't me," and wonder briefly what they were and where and feel the strangeness of being there.
I love that, the way that someone else's displacement has, in a way, a positive. It displaces everyone else, you know?
Yeah.
Another poem that I quite like in this issue is by a young writer, Nate Klug, and it's got a title that I never thought I'd find us publishing, True Love. I mean, a lot of people expect a poem to be called True Love, but we don't. But this one works. This is by Nate Klug. "Off rows of windshields in the Amtrak lot, rain in sudden clumps like jacks. Parked cars with people in them, awaiting people they imagine hurtling through suburbs of silver woods, awaiting them. True love needs interference, a certain blizzard distance for the words to worm through. Remember Iowa? August storms that would self-spark as if our fights could trip the finest wire beneath the sidewalk. And the sunlight, harder after." There's a lot I love about this, but I love that shift where he makes a statement, true love, and the line breaks right there, needs interference, so he's interfered with it. And then suddenly it's just a personal memory, remember Iowa.
Yeah.
And it just stabs you.
Well, there are propulsive parts of the poem, like the rain in sudden clumps like jacks.
Yeah.
And the August storms that would self-spark as if our fights could trip the finest wire beneath the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Those little explosions that take place, you know, in our lives and in our memories.
The sunlight's harder after, and you get the sense that love is both clearer and more difficult. Both those two things.
That's true love.
That's right. That's right. This month we have two poems from Valzina Mort. This is her second appearance in the magazine. In April of 2007, her poem New York appeared in our translation issue, and it was written in her native Belarusian.
She's currently a writer in residence at the University of Baltimore. She told us that since her last book, Factory of Tears, came out last year, she's been writing in English.
The poem we're about to hear is titled Jean-Paul Belmondo. Belmondo, of course, is the French actor associated with the New Wave films of the 60s, at least primarily. I mean, later on, he became famous as sort of an action figure.
Yeah, and his aura reached all the way to the Soviet Union. Mort tells us he loomed large for her as a child growing up there. He wasn't just your average sex symbol. He was a sex symbol from the West.
Sort of the Western, handsome man, adventurous and risky and intriguing. And so he was somebody whom my mother was very fond of, for example.
Mort hasn't outgrown her fascination with the actor, though you could say it's been scaled down a bit.
I wanted to write the whole opera to Jean-Paul Belmondo, but ended only with a three-page poem.
So this is an opera's extravagance, sort of compressed into three pages. Here's Valzina Mort reading Jean-Paul Belmondo.
It begins with your face of a stone, where lips repose like two seals. In a coastal mist of cigarette smoke, you move through the streets, and listing them is as useless as naming waves. The city is so handsome for a reason. It was made out of your rib. It continues with my skid marked by a dress, buddy. I stand on the border on heels like my sixth toes and show you where to park. That very night, lying together in the dog's yard, flowers are biting my back, you whisper, the longer I look at the coins of your nipples, the clearer I see the queen's profile. For you, body and money are the same as the chicken and the egg. The metaphor of a woman's purse escapes you. Stealing, you like to mumble, a purse is a purse is a purse is a purse. Also, a real purse in your hand is worth two metaphorical purses over your mouth. They tell me your body anchored to the shore by its rusting blood. Your wound darkens on your chest like a crow. I tell them, as agreed, that you are my youth, an apple that bit into me to forget its own knowledge. Death hands you every new day like a golden coin. As the bribe grows, it gets harder to turn it down, and your heart of gold gets heavier to carry. Your hands know that a car has a waist and a gun a lobe. You take me where the river once lifted its skirts, and God, abashed with that view, ordered to cover that shame with a city. Its dance square shrank by the darkness to the size of a sleeping infant's slightly open mouth. I cannot tell between beggars' stretched hands and dogs' dripping tongues. You cannot tell between legs. Mine, tables, chairs, others. The dance square is a cage where accordions green at dismembered violin torsos. Beggars lick thin air off their lips. Women whirling in salsa slash you across the chest with the blades of their skirts, soiled in peonies.
It sounds like it wasn't just her mother who liked Jean-Paul Belmondo, right?
No, that's quite an exciting poem. I mean, you know, everyone talks about Dickinson's thing about, you know, it's a poem if it takes the top of your head off. This kind of takes your shirt off.
Right, yeah.
It seems like every line has a wild thing in it.
It does. The images are very extravagant and playful and sexy, too.
Yeah.
But I love the descriptions. It begins with your face of a stone where lips repose like two seals. It's sort of mocking the idea of a love poem, but then it becomes a love poem later.
It really does. But every phrase seems to just shiver or make you shiver, you know. It continues with my skid marked by a dress body.
Yeah. It's a tiny dress.
Yeah.
It's a tiny dress. And the metaphor of a woman's purse escapes you. And then the next line is stealing. So he's stealing the purse, I guess. You like to mumble, a purse is a purse. So he's also stealing from Gertrude Stein. Right?
and everything under the sun, a real purse in your hand is worth two metaphorical purses over your mouth.
Yeah.
It's a wild poem.
Very exciting ending. Beggars lick thin air off their lips. Women whirling in salsa slash you across the chest with the blades of their skirts soiled with peonies.
Yeah, that's a dizzy and romantic ending there.
She's got English.
At least I think so.
She can write in English, can't she? It's amazing. Suddenly she decides to write in English and she writes a poem like this.
Unbelievable.
This month we feature three poems by Jill Alexander Essbaum. Essbaum's most recent collection is called The Devastation, published this year by Cooper Dillon Books. She's published three other books and she's from Texas.
The title of one of Essbaum's poems is Non Redibimus. Essbaum explains that you might see this phrase etched on a sundial. These Latin mottos are their own genre, really. One of the most well-known would be Tempus Fugit, or Time Flies.
There's a whole interesting lot of them. Man is but a shadow, and beware of a single hour. But this one translates from Latin to We Shall Not Come Again. I think they sort of take a function in a way of impersonal epitaphs. The way that, like, as I am here, you shall soon be, you know, kind of a moment of preaching in the desert. And they're not very funny. There's, you know, sometimes epitaphs, for example, can have a bit of like raw, wry humor, but they're always warnings.
Esbaum says she has a series in the works based on these mottos. Non Redhibimus is the first in the series. Here's Jill Alexander Esbaum reading Non Redhibimus.
We shall not come again, not to this wet and summer day, nor to the waylaid place where you laid waste to me, and I to you, and where we reminisced, recalling who did what to whom. We shall not come again, not to the bed we thrashed, nor to the memory of the way I brushed my hair back nights, nor to the air we dared to share to breathe, or couldn't quite. We shall not come again. No more, my face seemed round your corner, or your briefcase found beneath my table. We weren't able, apt, or sane. We shall not come again. Nor cry, nor clutch, not even once again. We shall not cover up in quilts, or bear the beasts of one another's guilts, or sit in silences made saddest by what was. We shall not come again. Because.
We could start by talking about the last word of this poem, because. That classic empty and usually final answer that a parent might give a kid. But in this case, it's the scene as a breakup between two adults.
It's a very sad ending. The last word, because, is in italics in the poem. The only other word in the poem in italics is also in the last line, was, you know, made saddest by what was. It's a very deliberate ending of a not quite rhyme of was and because. Your mouth tries to make it work and it doesn't.
Sometimes you're looking for an answer and there is no answer but the answer that you're given, which is the final thud of the breaking up or the no or the this isn't going to happen. And to keep looking for that answer when you've or a reason for that answer is futility. Because you have the answer is no.
It's a great poem of denial.
Yeah, and also a poem of fadedness.
Yeah.
It has a real feel of fadedness like the epitaph does.
It reminds me of Eliot's Four Quartets a little bit. You know, it has that recurring thing about we shall not come again, which isn't what Eliot says exactly. And this is as if the Four Quartets were written in a personal wasteland instead of some kind of moment of real enlightenment.
Although, because it's her, and, you know, I know a lot of her other poems, and the way this is, you know, this wet and summer day, the waylaid place where you laid waste to me, it has a sexual implication.
Yes.
And she keeps mentioning it again and again, we shall not come again. And
right.
The poem really owes something to Edna St. Vincent Millay and structure and her playfulness.
That's really true. I hadn't thought of that. It's quite a poem for people to try out when they worry about things not going well.
Yeah.
There's another poem we have time for by Jill in the issue. This is a little poem called Poem.
A clementine of inclement climate grows tart. A crocus, too stoic to open, won't. Like an oyster that cloisters, a spoil of pearls untouched. The heart that's had enough stays shut.
I mean, that's such an impacted little poem, and the rhymes are so woven into the lines you can't unstitch anything at all.
They're like pearls on a string.
Right, crocus and stoic, and those aren't at the end of the lines. They're in the middle, oyster and cloisters and pearls and heart and shut and enough. It's really tightly crammed, that little poem.
Yeah.
It won't open.
It won't.
Also in the December issue, we have an essay by Australian poet and environmental activist John Kinsella.
Kinsella has written over 20 books of poetry. He's the founding editor of the journal Salt in Australia, and he serves as international editor at the Kenyon Review.
In addition to his literary and teaching activities, Kinsella is an activist. And his essay in the magazine this month is about how poetry and activism connect for him. He joins us by phone from his home in Western Australia. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Good. It's a kind of strange morning here in the West Australian wheat belt. It looks a bit stormy, actually.
Oh, really? What is the view out your window?
Well, windows are really important to me. I've written a lot about windows. As I look out the window, there are kind of what they call York gums. There are acacias, or what we call here jam trees, because the saps are kind of raspberry jam color. Granite rocks, And, yeah, it's spreading up to a kind of blue horizon with some dark clouds on it. And this time of year, it's very, very dry. But we're having a few late spring storms at the moment. But also, you can see some 28 parrots, as they're called, and some black-faced cuckoo shrikes. And yesterday, my partner Tracy saw an 8-foot guava snake go past the window. So, in fact, she stepped out the front door and was 2 foot away from it. So, pretty active here.
Snake and all, it sounds like paradise.
It can be paradise, but it's also it's an environment that's under a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. It's a rural area, and people tend to want to clear everything and to overuse the land. And there's also it's land taken from other people. It's taken from the Ballardong Noongar people in this region. So it's paralyzed with a lot of qualifications.
Well, you describe a particularly eventful and violent weekend in your essay. Began around 9 o'clock in the evening on a Friday when you heard some gunshots. What was going on there?
Yeah, well, you hear gunshots around here a lot, but this was really, really close. And it was a very dark night. I went outside and I heard more gunshots. I don't mean low-caliber rifles either. I mean really high-caliber rifles. And probably, I guess, a few hundred yards away. And I yelled and said that they shouldn't be there. And in the end, the spotlight turned around towards me and they started firing shots towards me. So anyway, it turned out that they were doing a fox hunt and they'd gone off the big farm that they'd been hunting on into a reserve, which even in the sort of meager laws of this place is not allowed, and had come down the laneway that goes from the reserve towards our place. And you know, we've got kids and all the rest of it, and it was not a good evening.
In your piece, you say you think about your writing and your poetry in particular as being a form of resistance against this kind of encroachment and this kind of violence and environmental destruction. I wonder, would you say that any poem written today in which nature figures, you know, very prominently is automatically a poem of resistance just because the environment is under assault?
I think that most poets in the languages I'm familiar with and cultures I'm familiar with write a poem of resistance even if they wouldn't declare it as such, because there's not that many people out there in poetry world who celebrate the destruction of the natural environment. Very, very few. So, you know, even if they're writing about the kind of lyrical eye beauty of the rose and their relationship with the rose or of anything else that is quotation marks nature, they are articulating a kind of position that is defending that and acclaiming it and giving it value, giving it more than the sum of its parts. And I think that becomes an articulation of resistance. So, yeah, in answer to that, I think so. I think the poets are at the forefront of resisting environmental damage and encroachment, even if they're not conscious of it.
Well, a lot of poets would trot out Auden's phrase, poetry makes nothing happen. But you actually say in your essay that poems can stop bulldozers.
They can. And I've done it. I've seen it happen. When I was 19 years old, I was involved in a protest down near the city where they were clearing this vast amount of swamp area. And a lot of the guys I was with had, they dealt with the bulldozers in their own way without going into details. And I said to them, look, all that will happen is I'll fix them up the next day. They'll arrest you and keep doing the same thing. So I went down there with a mate and started literally shouting poetry that I'd written at the bulldozer drivers. You know, a couple of them sort of came over and had a conversation and we got talking, and I pointed out that at that particular time I'd been working in a factory. I could sort of relate to where they were coming from as workers, and it had an effect. Now, they actually didn't mean that they didn't clear that swamp area. They did, but the bulldozer drivers I was interacting with did alter the way they thought about the place, and they said, we'll take a bit of care over there. We won't just sort of wipe that whole side out and so on. It didn't stop the development, but it did leave little pockets of bush intact that they would have just run roughshod over if I hadn't interacted with them. Poetry's about interaction, rather than sitting on this sort of tower and saying that this is the great art and it's holier than thou and it's really about the special people who have access to poetry. Well, what a load of crap. And that's one example of probably 30 or 40 I could name over a lifetime of protesting, where being a poet, A, and B, talking and reading poetry to people has actually changed the discourse.
You know, I think of poets like John Clare writing about enclosure, or other poets like Wendell Berry or even Robinson Jeffers. Can you think of any great poems about the environment that have changed you or given you sustenance?
Well, those three poets are actually three of my favorite poets. And I was looking at Wendell Berry's selected poems recently. In some ways, the area of America that he's talking about in the small farm, I think his farm is from memory about 70 acres or something like that. There are strong similarities, but ultimately incredibly different in its coordinates as well. I mean, the Australian landscape is so fundamentally different, it does create a different conversation. So you can have comparisons. But really, the poems that have so greatly affected me, certainly as a poet activist, have come from Australia. East Coast, so a long way from here, thousands and thousands of kilometres from here, Judith Wright, you know, from my childhood, had a huge effect on me. Also, an Indigenous poet from Queensland, Murray, M-U-R-R-I, Indigenous poet, Lionel Fogarty, who I think is the most interesting and dynamic poet writing in Australia, who writes this poetry of resistance against the invasiveness of colonial culture and creates almost a new language in the process of reclaiming his own language.
Do you feel like you're there for good now, John? Are you going to stay in Australia? Are you going to return to the States? Or?
Well, I've changed my whole mode of living. I'm not flying anymore. I gave up in July 2008, but I'm going back to the States by freighter. It's an 84-day round trip, which is an interesting thing. And I found that freighter is the most ecologically sound way of traveling a vast distance. And you can get on one of those. They usually have two cabins available. I suppose you write a book on the way across. Enough time, almost.
Yeah, I'd have to swap the decks.
I'd have to take 84 days off of work to do that.
Yeah, well, you've got to do 84 days of work on there. That's the point, I suppose.
Right,
and make
right.
sure you can pay for it when you finish. But that's what I'm doing. So I haven't removed the internationalism from my agenda, if you like. I've just changed the nature of it. Things are going to be much slower, take much longer, but that's okay. I think that's really the only solution to the eating of the resources, with big quotation marks around the resources of the world, is to slow things down considerably.
Thanks so much for being with us today, John.
No worries.
John Kinsella's critical book, Activist Poetics, will be published next year by Liverpool University Press.
You can read John Kinsella's essay, Vermin, a Notebook, and everything else you've heard on this program in the December issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.